do it.
Thank you.
Get comfortable.
I wonder whether or not the next day will feel obligated.
This one we will.
Yes. I like the idea that there's no investment we can get into.
Okay, I'll do that.
You mean that, they don't get a...
Good morning.
Morning.
I think almost everyone is here. One member still... Deborah's on her way back. So we're going to be together 40 minutes. We hope you feel comfortable. We try to make this as comfortable as we can. This is kind of a discussion. We're going to allow you to introduce yourselves. I'll have the board introduce ourselves, and then you'll introduce yourselves. You can run through your presentation. We tend to be more spontaneous and just ask questions as they come up, as you go along, if that doesn't
perfect
you out
perfect
too much.
Yeah. That's,
keep
that's
more
just better
discussion
that way.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'll start with Jerry.
Confidentiality. No, the confidentiality.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Thank you. This is a public meeting. It's actually being recorded, so we need you to waive your confidentiality on this panel.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Jerry.
Jerry Holcomb, trustee.
Terry Buck, trustee.
John Phillips, trustee, and go Bears.
My father says that to me, too.
Marilyn Leadham, CEO.
Maria Teresa, I am chair of the board.
Jerry Tellis, retiree rep.
Rusty Watts, trustee.
Mr. Allen, trustee.
Kate Barbier, trustee.
Thank you. I'm Susan Carter. I'm president and CEO of Common Fund Capital, and it's a distinct pleasure to be here with you this morning. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you.
Greg Jansen, managing director.
Ken Scott, managing director.
Seon Kang, managing director on the sales and service team based in San Francisco. So, as Sue mentioned, we're very honored to be here today. Thank you very much for having us. Sue, just I'll do a little bit more of an introduction and then turn it over to Sue. But Sue is the president and CEO of Common Fund Capital. She joined Common Fund in 1989 from Morgan Stanley Venture Partners and has spent her entire career working in private equity and private real assets investing. Greg, as mentioned, is an MD on our investment team, an investment committee member, and the head of our private real assets program. He was trained as a geophysicist, worked at Amoco for 6.5 years before moving into financial services, and joined Common Fund in 1995. And then to my immediate left is Kent Scott, also an MD IC member, and similar to all the other five IC members, has direct experience on the private equity side of the business, or the private capital investing side of the business. He joined Common Fund 11 years ago after having worked at Credit Suisse and UBS, and perhaps most importantly, he is a Contra Costa County native, having attended elementary, middle, and high schools in Concord and Walnut Creek.
Northgate, Foothill, Money Gardens.
Las Lomas.
Yeah, ah. Sorry.
And I also lived in Contra Costa County when I went to Cal. So we're here to speak to you today about our ninth private real assets program. And out of this current fund, we will make about 15 underlying investments, or intend to invest with about 15 underlying managers, and we've already made 6 primary commitments. During our time this morning, we will give you an overview of Common Fund, talk about our investment approach, due diligence process, and our long track record in history. With that, I'll turn it over to Sue.
Great. Thank you, Seon, and thank you very much again for the opportunity to present to you this year, 2013, is Common Fund Capital's 25th anniversary. So we believe we're one of the few organizations that have a very long track record in private real asset investing. In fact, the first program that was started when our firm was founded in 1988 was an energy program. So it's now evolved into what we call natural resources and what you're calling real assets. So we think we have one of the longest and the deepest track records. On page 4 of our presentation, we're showing you a little bit about our organizational structure. So Common Fund Capital, which is the organization that we represent, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the broader Common Fund, which was started in 1971 and is a global investment management company. In Common Fund Capital, we focus on 3 areas: private natural resources, private venture capital, and private equity. And we do all 3 of those areas with a global footprint. So we look at everything that we do through the lens of where are the best opportunities all around the world. We are registered with the SEC, and we have been so since our founding. And in natural resources, we have $2.5 billion in commitments to 9 different programs that we're responsible for. In terms of programs, we offer a new one about once every 2 to 3 years. So we will launch a program, we will assess where we think the opportunities are, and so what we're here today to talk to you about is our 9th program, as Sayan mentioned, which we have just started. And our prior 8 programs give you a pretty good flavor for how we approach the business and how we construct portfolios. So we put together portfolios which are a mix of primary manager commitments, a few secondary investments, and some direct co-investments as well, all constructed within one program. In terms of our natural resources, we follow the current strategy that we're doing today. We started that in 1995, so we have a long record of doing this. The $2.5 billion of commitments that have been made to our 9 programs have come from 370 unique investors. And in terms of our track record, we've generated a 2.2 times net cash multiple. And what that means, more specifically, is that for every dollar that our investors have invested with us, we've returned $2.20 on our realized investments. And because we've been at this for a long period of time, we have realized investments. We've actually taken programs full cycle. So we've raised them, invested them, and harvested them. An awful lot of people in the business today are just getting started, and so they can only show you unrealized returns, but we can show you a realized record as well, which I think is very important, because in these long-term asset classes, you really don't know how you've done until the end of a program. You can look at interim internal rates of return, but they're just that, they're interim, and they're not final until the program is final. So our 2.2 times net multiple also translates to a 17% net IRR. Now that 17% net IRR includes our realized and our unrealized investments, and it's net of all fees. So that is exactly the calculation that our investors would do on their investment if they factored in all the cash flows for all the investments that they've made with us. So it's net of everything, which I think is very important. Our goal, and the long-term goal that we think is appropriate for natural resource investments, is between 10 and 15% on an absolute return basis. So we're really pleased that we've actually exceeded our own target that we set 25 years ago when we started out doing natural resource investing.
You mentioned that the 17% was realized and unrealized. We had a question earlier. How solid are the unrealized returns?
The unrealized returns, I think, are quite solid. Managers tend, in their valuation policies, to, if anything, be more conservative on the valuations on the unrealized investments. And there are pretty strict guidelines that are followed. We serve on about 75 different valuation committees, so we review those valuations typically on a quarterly or semi-annual basis for most of the managers that we work with, and they follow, as I said, pretty rigorous guidelines. We've looked back at that because we wanted to test how good are these interim valuations, and we found that on average, I think, Kent, you did the study, there's about a 25% increase between what a manager is holding an investment at and what they ultimately sell it at.
That's in our portfolios,
And across time in our portfolios, and that's across a fairly large sample set.
Bob, I would also add that PricewaterhouseCoopers is finishing their annual audit right now. In fact, I was on the phone with them at 5:45 this morning. They're back on the East Coast, and we're going through all the valuations of various, down even to the company level. And so, you know, we think those companies are performing overall very well.
They review right down to individual reserve report information, so they're quite detailed. On page 5, we're just looking at a snapshot of our organization. Again, we started in 1988. Common Fund Capital has 45 employees. About half are on our investment team and about half on our finance and accounting team. And then there are about another 45 people who work for the broader Common Fund, our parent organization, and we tap into them for legal advice, risk management, compliance, and those other pieces of our due diligence process that we think are very important. In terms of this team and the track record, what we're here to talk to you about and the track record we're showing you belongs to the group that's still in place today making the investments. So we're a very stable team. We've been together a long time. And the investment committee that's in place today is the investment committee that's generated the results that we're showing you. In fact, we've worked together, and we have approved over 750 different investments across our programs over time. We operate out of Wilton, Connecticut, which is about an hour outside of New York, and we have investment offices also in London and in Beijing, again, helping us to form our global viewpoint. When you think about what we do, most all of our work is focused on selecting the best investment opportunities in these sectors. And Greg and Kent are going to talk to you a little bit more about our process. But on top of selecting the best investments, we then work at portfolio construction and putting together a mix of well-established, what we would call perhaps lower-risk investments, together with a smattering of newer or perhaps higher risk investments. And that portfolio construction is a very important part of our value add in the process. We also believe very strongly at Common Fund, and one of our core values is, and a lot of people say this, but having worked at a few other organizations, I can say Common Fund is quite unique in making decisions that are in the best interest of our clients. And we do that in a variety of ways, but one of the ways is that we attempt to be the lowest or among the lowest fee providers for what we do. So if you look at the way we calculate our fees, we think we are very close to the lowest, and that's part of the value proposition, because at the end of the day, it has a significant impact on your ultimate return. In addition, we look to align our interests with our investors by making personal investments in our programs. So since about the year 2000, we've been writing personal checks alongside our investors for significant portions of our net worth for our investments in all of our core programs. And that's a really important part of working at Common Fund and we think aligning our interests with our investors. One of the things I did want to touch on is the fact that Common Fund is often known or thought about in terms of our early history of working with college and university endowments. And that goes back to our founding 42 years ago. In fact, since our founding, we have also managed quite a significant amount of retirement assets and public assets. But it's about 3 years ago when we elected to work with public pensions. And so you would be certainly not our first public pension, but you would be early in that process, and therefore for us, a very important client, and I can commit to you that you would get a lot of senior level attention from our organization, and we would be honored to work with you. The next several pages look at our team. I mentioned the stability of our team and the length of time that we've all worked together. One of the things that differentiates us, and Sayan mentioned it when she introduced Kent, is quite a number of the members of our team have actually worked in the shoes of the managers that we're hiring. We've worked on the direct side of the business. We've made direct investments in these companies that are the portfolio companies that we're evaluating. And that allows us to make, we think, better investment decisions, ask more detailed questions, and perhaps be a more value-added investor to the managers that we're working with. And I think that's a big part of the reason that we've been asked to serve on so many different manager valuation committees and advisory committees. If you jump ahead, the pictures are our investment team. But if you jump ahead to page 10, let's look specifically at our natural resources team and who we rely on most. Most importantly on that in this program, and we call on the expertise of our full investment committee. In fact, I started at Common Fund in 1989. It was 1992 when I started getting involved in natural resource investing. And today, Greg Jansen and Kent Scott, who are here, together with Peter Burns, all have primary manager responsibilities in the natural resources areas. We're particularly proud of the significant technology background of our team members. So you heard that Greg is a geophysicist, But what does that mean, and how does that help us to make better decisions? Well, Greg can actually understand the technology. He can read the seismic reports and the reserve reports, and he can read the maps that a lot of the managers and the portfolio company CEOs bring to the meetings to describe the particular investment opportunity. And some of the rest of us have been around that a while. We've got a flavor for it. But to be actually trained in it and have done that for 7 years in his career is a real value add. And it's not just a value add in the investments that we've made, but I would say most importantly, perhaps in the valuations that we've chosen to pass on, because there's an awful lot of things that look really good on paper, but they just don't check out at the end of the day. And Greg's been able to maintain his network of contacts. And so all of us now really focus on, in our reference checking, going off the reference list. So a manager will give you a list of references to call to decide whether or not you want to invest. Well, that's important, and we do that, and we check that box. But you get your best references when you go off the reference list and call the people that you know and check the folks out that way. And that's really valuable. In addition, it's not just Greg with a technology background. We've got Ethan Levine, who has two technical degrees and an MBA. He's worked at an energy consultant and a direct energy manager, and we're delighted to have him on the team. And then we call on both our London and our Beijing offices, where there's a lot of activity in natural resources. Leon Liu also has a technical degree. He heads up our Beijing office. And, in fact, his first job was with Sinopec, one of China's largest energy companies. And Mark Hoeing and Deb Wang, who are in our London office, actually spend upwards of 50% of their time in natural resources. So there's quite a bit of activity, which Greg will describe in more detail, both in the UK North Sea area and in and around Scandinavia. So that's our full team. And I'll pause here and ask if there are any questions on our organization. And if not, turn it to Greg to talk about more of the specifics of our program and the role of natural resources in an institutional portfolio.
Sue, one quick question. Excuse me. What is your focus on North America versus the rest of the world, as you described?
China, we have a page on
London,
that, actually.
Et cetera.
Yeah, it's roughly, and we can show you on the page, roughly two-thirds North America and two-thirds North America. And I can cover it now, or we can go in order if you want. I can kind of show you exactly what we're talking
in
about.
In order is fine. What caused me to ask the question was the focus, to some degree, on the description of going international to advisory people. And
you know, it really is. I mean, our program has evolved from a U.S.-centric program years ago, decades ago, to a North American program, to a European North American program, and now really full global. And so we have managers, we have companies, we have investments in all four corners of the earth. In fact, I can show you a map of that.
Why don't you do that?
I would say that, though, much of the activity is still in North America. But stepping back, we have a global franchise. We have a global team. We really want to take advantage of that. We're really one of the only people, we think, in our business that do have that truly global team focused just on natural resources. And these are commodity businesses. So if you can buy oil in the ground or a copper mine in Chile versus the U.S., it's really all about assessing risk and valuations. And so we're very much opportunistic-centric about moving around the world and trying to gain the best values we can. That's really been more of our focus over the last 5 and 7 years as we've built out our franchise around the world.
Page 23 actually depicts our footprint. When Greg says North America, it's really Canada that is the additional country in addition to the U.S. Quite a bit of activity up there. But this gives you a snapshot of where we're located and where our investment managers are located and where the investments, the underlying portfolio company investments are located.
So those companies would be in the blue. In our portfolios, the orange circles would be where our managers have offices. And then the stars are where we have our offices, Connecticut, London, Beijing. And we think that it's a global business. You really have to attack it from a global franchise. It's really, you know, we think of the powerful way of investing.
Questions?
Yeah.
You mentioned the net IRR 17%. Do you know the gross IRR?
You know, I'll be really honest with you. We actually don't even focus on that. Most people provide that, but it's all about net. It doesn't matter what the gross numbers are. The difference between the two, people like to focus on that, but all we care about is what are we delivering back to our investors. So I actually don't know that. I could take a hazard a guess at it. It would be a couple of percentage points higher.
Given that your fees are lower than other people's fees,
the gap is
they're going to
less.
Be closer together.
The gap is less.
Yeah. If no other questions, I'm happy to move back to page 11, just talk very briefly over the next several pages about the investment objectives of our programs, of real assets in general. The focus points we have is, number one, to produce attractive performance. Sue mentioned that 10 to 15% net results in flat pricing environments. We're not looking for prices to sort of bail us out and give us better performance. We're really looking for the value add of people we work with, the managers, the management teams, to really build successful companies, to grow companies from very small franchises to larger franchises. That's really where the alpha or the performance is coming from. Number two there would be to produce diversification benefits for an overall portfolio. And you probably focus as a team here on trying to find low and negative correlating asset areas with other assets. I'm happy to show you some data. This program does that. And also, we want to act as a potential hedge against inflation. And so I'm happy to punctuate those three points on the following pages to demonstrate our results. And starting on page 12, Sue really covered most of this page. On the left-hand side, we're looking at our real asset performance. On a cost basis of $600 million, we've distributed back cash, and this is net, back to our investors, $1.3 billion. That's that 2.2 multiple net of all fees and expenses that Sue mentioned. And then that 17% is, again, what we've realized, but also what's unrealized in our portfolio. Much of what's in our portfolio is still held at cost. It's still building value. This is a very long-term industry. It's a cyclical business. And I think that the most beneficial way of looking at performance is to look, again, long-term over decades, because that's at least what we focus on, not short-term, interim results. Page 13 just carries on with the diversification benefits. And what we've done here is we've correlated our programs with select indices, select benchmarks. And this is where you want to see negative and low correlations with other areas. So for instance, fixed income, the benchmark there, the Barclays Bond Index, our programs, if you correlate our programs over time, we have a negative correlation with the bond index. That's really critical. There's very few asset areas that have a negative correlation with bonds. And what that means is when bonds are doing poorly, this area probably can do well. So something in your portfolio can actually climb, especially when there's inflation. You can also see that the correlation with equities, which are quite low. The S&P 500 at 0.21, that again is a very low correlation. And so it's somewhat unique to this area. By the way, this is actual data of our programs, not hypothetical empirical data. This is what we've been tracking over the last 20 years. And then finally in that sequence, potential inflation hedge on page 14. And here what you want to see as we correlate our programs with CPI is you want to see the most positive correlations you can get. And in fact, our programs correlated, again, over the last couple of decades, has a very strong positive correlation with CPI, even higher than the NCREIF Real Estate Index, commodities, and TIPS. Those are other styles of inflation hedges. And if you want more information on inflation hedges, we wrote a research paper about a year and a half ago. It's still very current. We're happy to send that to you.
Okay. Could you share a little bit, as you're moving on to page 15, on your conviction level, why you outline your portfolio high, moderate, and low. Could you share a little bit about why low, why moderate, why high? You know, what made you make conviction investments in your high portfolio versus your low?
Sure. So as we move to page 15, what we're showing here is what we think is fully contained within real assets. These are all the sub-industries. There's really a half a dozen of them. And the photographs illustrate those sub-indices. The names are on top, oil and gas, the various services, infrastructure, mining, clean energy, and other. We break down, Maria, our conviction levels with the highest we have in green at this point in time, moderate in the brown, and the low in the lighter beige color. This, by the way, moves as valuations change across time, and it's sort of natural for that to happen. So right now, our largest conviction levels are, starting on the left-hand side, in oil and gas, the development and production business. You probably all heard about this energy renaissance that's talked about. We wrote a paper on that last year, and we're happy to send that to you. But the fact that, as an example, there's been a 40% increase in oil production here in the U.S. over the last 5 years. That's really extraordinary. So we've really been a big beneficiary of that in our portfolio since we've been investing in oil and gas now for 2 decades. So there's been hundreds of companies that have been driven through a growth cycle, some of it using the new technology that you hear about. And again, it's been a great benefit to us. Exploration is a much lower focus for us. It's really outside of the risk return of what we're trying to achieve in our portfolios. We're really trying to strive for somewhat moderate to low risk in our portfolios, meaning that we'll have work with very high quality management teams that have been through cycles, just like ourselves, over many cycles over the decades, investing through those cycles, using low financial leverage. That's really the keynotes of our success in natural resources. Some other interesting areas are the various services, and I'll start with oil field services. And so a lot of companies that have developed the technologies that are used here in North America, and now are really moving that across the world. It's technology like we have a company in environmental services called R360. So they take all that frac fluid you hear about, they can actually clean that up now to a potable standard before releasing that into groundwater or reusing that into the next well. So when you hear about horizontal drilling, fracture stimulation, regulation is actually increasing the capabilities and the revenue source of these sorts of companies. And we've been investing in these environmental services companies now for many years. R360, which just recently sold out of our portfolio, a very strong result. And we have other companies that do similar things. There's also companies that do exploration, drilling, completion technologies. Old oil and gas wells are like old Victorian homes. The older they are, the more work they need. And so we focus most of our time and attention on that side of the spectrum. It's really the millions of wells that around the U.S. and around the world that are still producing that need more and more attention going forward, and hopefully new technology that will actually increase production in those wells.
Terry?
With so much stuff that you guys have in oil and gas and stuff like that, what's going to happen if oil price drops to $50 a barrel?
We try to sensitize our portfolio to see what happens, especially when we're doing our own co-investing and secondary investing. We can talk about that. And that's one of the things that we try to do. And we think, by and large, we'd still be profitable in the $50 to $60 range with a number of our companies in the portfolio. But I would say that that would not be a healthy metric for our portfolio. It's happened before. We've had drops as low as $9 a barrel in our portfolio. And those funds, and I'll show them to you, have really generated very strong performance. These are very long-term strategies. What's probably more important is what the price of oil will be in that case for the next 10 and 20 years, not sort of this year, next year, the year after.
What I've been impressed with is the ability of the underlying investment managers that we hire to time the purchase of the company and the sale of the company. So if you look over time at any one of our programs, which are generally 12 years in life, you have a lot of commodity price cycles within that 12-year period. And what we find is that when pricing is either high or low, the managers are either buying or selling, and they do a pretty good job of getting that right. So we have had dips, as Greg mentioned. They're good buying opportunities, and we've had some peaks. They're good selling opportunities, and that's part of the expertise that we're relying on them for.
And if that was to happen, would you start looking at farmland, water, timber, things like that?
I'm going to make one other point to Sue's point. So one of the key things that we look for in our real assets focused managers across all areas, because they're all more or less facing top lines that move around due to commodity pricing, is that they're at the lower end, the lowest end of the cost curve. And so that buffers you the best in terms of with your top line moving around. And the point you're making here on, you know, how does this move over time is a very valid one that we review and we do make changes. An example would be timber, which we studied for 7 years before we made our first investment in 2003. And then we observed in the industry that there was a lot of money flowing into it. It was driving the prices, you know, different from what we thought the underlying fundamentals justified. And so we haven't made an investment since that time period. We think that there will be And we're starting to see the first evidence of good potential secondary investments in timber. But you know, we're evaluating all these spaces on a risk-adjusted basis versus where else we can invest. And that does change over time, depending on what we see in the environment, with the view that these are very long-term asset classes. So we're not buying and selling on what we think the price is going to do next week, next year, but on a much, you know, 3-5 year.
What do you see in the area of other renewables?
Yeah, other renewables, we actually have several projects in the landfill gas area. We still think that's an attractive area. We have a co-investment in that space as well. The landfill gas metrics, the economics we think are attractive, is also what's called renewable portfolio standards. So the states themselves, California as an example, wants at least 20% of their electricity to be produced from renewables.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're actually trying to raise that to closer to 30. Most states are around 20 right now. That we think is an attractive area. And you might say, you might ask, why not wind, solar, and clean tech on the bottom? It's not that we don't like those areas. We spend a lot of time, Jerry, in those areas. It's just that the relative rates of return in those areas are below what we're trying to achieve. Many of them are low-risk return infrastructure projects. And there's actually a fair amount of money to be invested in that space. So that's changed across time as well.
And then we're also looking on a non-subsidized basis. So, you know, some of these areas have benefited from subsidies over time, but, you know, sometimes those subsidies can go away. So, again, in a very long-term business, we don't bank on those subsidies continuing. That combined with the fact that we're not willing to give up anything that we look for in due diligence in terms of the fundamentals on team, strategy, performance as an indicator of what they might do in the future, sifts out some of those, particularly in sort of the hot phase when they go through some of these waves of being really popular and then cool off as realized returns come in, sometimes different than what people hope for at the outset. So that's, you know, gives another flavor or context for how we look at these programs over time.
Could you walk us through your exit strategy if you realize you made a commitment, it is not working? What are your steps to get out? Can you face that, and who makes that decision?
Yeah, we have faced that over time. When we're working in a partnership, when we're investing in a primary manager, the way is to either liquidate that naturally over time, allow those investments to liquidate over the years, or sell that security. And in certain cases, we've sold securities. In our third fund, and we'll show the results, very strong results, we sold one of those manager securities because we actually lost faith in some respects with that manager.
Would that be a limited partnership piece?
Correct. We are generally, though, more active on the buy side on the secondary market. We're one of the largest participants in buying secondaries in the natural resources space in the business right now. In fact, after the credit crisis, we think we may have been the largest buyer of secondaries. And in fact, when oil prices fell to 40 after, you know, in 2008 and 2009, we were a large buyer of secondaries, buying people out of their partnerships. And that fund, we'll show the results, has really extraordinary results as a result of that.
Those are really great. Is your process different for co-investors, or that includes co-investors?
You know, it remains similar in some respects. We still have the investment committee that actually opines on everything and approves everything. But it takes, we think, a much more specialized skill set to focus on co-investments. Typically, we might be down to the field level, the mine itself, the infrastructure project, that renewable project. We made a co-investment in the landfill gas space. We were literally down in the weeds ourselves. There's a lot of data to analyze. We like that. We're used to that. That's really another portion of the skill sets that's required to, we think, generate good returns there.
And we've done that since really the beginning of the program, because in such, you know, a specialized field, we've always felt that you can't be so strict on, I'm only going to invest in primary investments. So we've always done secondaries and co-investments. Greg was on actively involved with a company in our third and fourth fund that had a lot of different things that it had to go through. It was a North Sea exploration and production company, and you know, he effectively was on the board of directors of that. And when we look at those types of investments, they all are going into one fund, so they all have to stack up to the bar that we have for the fund. And there are times when secondaries are very interesting, right after the credit crisis where we were very active, and then there are other times when there's just a lot of money pouring in and the rates of return go way down, And that's when we really scale it back, or we don't, you know, we bid on a number of things, but we don't end up winning it. The same for co-invest. It's got to be measured against the one bar that we have for the fund.
Have the returns that you've achieved in co-investment been comparable to the achieves in your the returns in your primary?
In natural resources, they've actually been higher. But I think that I would say that that's still a pretty small part of what we do. We're generally a primary focused manager. And again, we can show that to you in the book. So, Maria, you asked a question. I want to finish your question really quickly. We focus not only on oil and gas. The energy renaissance in North America, that's expanding around the world. We want to travel around the world. I was in Beijing last month. We are working on the same kind of strategies in China. They need the energy renaissance. They have horrible air quality, as you know. If you can get China to move from coal to natural gas, you'd have a really great positive impact for the environment for all of us. And so we're trying to follow that trend. We like the services businesses, not only oil and gas. We like power services, the engineering services, software, maintenance, and so forth for power plants. That's really interesting. We focus on the midstream business. You've probably heard a lot about MLPs. So if you drill a new field, gas field, unconventional gas field, the Marcellus Shale in the Appalachians, you have to actually hook up all those gas wells to market. There's no infrastructure. So you actually have to help gather, treat, process, move that gas to someone's home so they could use it for, say, cooking. That's been a big driver of our portfolio over the years. We're taking that show on the road as well. We have companies now, co-investments up in Canada. We're looking for opportunities in the rest of the world. And then the mining business right now we think is quite attractive. And Terry, when you asked about oil prices, many of the commodities in mining are way off. Iron ore, as an example, has fallen substantially over the last year and a half. So we think there's a real dearth of capital, a lack of capital in mining right now compared to other parts of natural resources. It's an area that we've spent particular time on recently. It's not just here in North America, but it's all around the world.
Another part of your question that I want to make sure we answer, you asked who makes those decisions when we sell, and I want to be clear that the investment committee that we outlined, the six people in Common Fund Capital, make all the investment decisions or are responsible for all the investment decisions for all of our programs, and that would include buy decisions and sell decisions. So if we decided to divest ourselves of a fund or a co-investment, it would be that same investment committee. We are three of the six people. There are also two members of our team who are managing directors who are coming up and who right now are observers on that investment committee, and that's because we want to make sure we always have people who are learning the process from the investment committee.
So you see your observers, this was discussed at the board before you came, so when you have observers, that's basically pre-training for board participation.
Exactly.
So I was an observer for a couple years before I joined the committee full-time, and it's just a great way to get socialized, practice, and then step up and become a full member.
Thank you. Any other questions? Just to make sure the board...
Shadowing you.
Okay, move on.
We might skip a few of the pages. 16 is just our funnel. Suffice to say, we looked last year alone at on page 16 at 586 opportunities globally. We held 215 meetings. We made only six commitments. That's 1% of all the opportunities that we saw. So we want to have a very vast funnel. We want to see everything we possibly can around the world. We have an incredible database we've had for 20 years. It's state of the art, but more importantly, it has a lot of rich data over the last 20 years, notes, records, and so forth you can go back to. We think we have a very rigorous process.
How many managers do you still have that you had all the way back to your first fund?
We have none back to our first funds. We still have several in our third and fourth funds, 18 years ago. And I would say that the last fund, about 40% of the capital was to new opportunities in our last fund. We think plus or minus it'll be about the same in this program.
What we're trying to do fundamentally is find people who are differentiated. And so all the work we do on diligence and the network that we have and the long history titrates into finding these excellent managers where you have an asset class where the dispersion between the top quartile and the bottom quartile is in the thousands of basis points. We think that when you can find those differentiated managers, and as long as they keep doing what you know we think makes them special, we do all our diligence with every single fund, whether it's the first time we work with them or the eighth time that we've worked with them, you have that positive optionality to re-up in, frankly, a place where many of our managers are not accessible to new people coming along. So that's by design, the construct of the program is to not turn over things, you know, 100% cycle to cycle, but to find managers that you can be with, checking along the way as they're raising new funds, and then, you know, committing to those that are really special and really differentiated.
But being a previous manager doesn't eliminate you as well, though.
Doesn't eliminate you,
no.
But it also doesn't mean that you're definitely
you still have to be a performer in order
we
to...
We redo the work every single time. Right. Some of those managers that we've been with since 1995 are highly sought-after managers with capacity-constrained seats at the table, and we're very grateful to have them. They've performed well for a long period of time. SCF Partners is an example of a manager that we originally met in the early 90s, and they've done a fantastic job. They've kept their fund sizes flat. They don't take in new investors, and we're one of their largest investors. It's a core part of our ninth fund that you are considering. So that's an example where being with a manager for a long period of time has served us and our investors very well, and we're very pleased to have that relationship.
Jerry, if you go to page 22, you can see the composition of the fund that we're actually raising right now. And you're at a sort of an interesting part of the process. You can actually see a good part of what we're actually building and decide if you want to commit to this program or not. And Sue mentioned SCF Partners. You'll see on the upper right-hand side, they've just raised their Fund 8. We committed about $40 million to that manager. That's the largest, probably the largest manager commitment we'll make in this program. It's a highly sought after manager. They had no new investors. They raised a $500 million fund 18 years ago, and wow. This fund was a $600 million fund, so very focused on sticking to their knitting. Great technical operating team. It's only gotten better over time. It's a really extraordinary manager with phenomenal results, and we're pleased to be one of the largest investors there. Other people we work with, you'll see different vintages of funds. We'll work with brand new managers. We'll work with Fund 8 managers. By and large, we want to have a mix because working, for instance, with just new managers, that we don't think is necessarily a recipe for success. There's a high risk factor when working with brand new people or people that haven't worked together before. So we generally mix that with much more established managers. And you'll also see on page 22, we've made three co-investments. One, M4, it's a midstream opportunity. Mm-hmm. This is where actually I've known the CFO for over 25 years. We used to be bankers, each bankers. Modern Resources, an oil and gas company in Calgary, and Canada, another midstream company, up in Canada. We think Canada is a really interesting opportunity for midstream as valuations in the U.S. have moved up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. One of the neat things about this as well, too, is that, you know, as with many areas, people who do really well want to be associated with people who are doing very well. And so it sets up a positive cycle for us where with managers that, you know, they have much more demand than they have supply in funds. When we call them and ask them about other people, they can, you know, steer us one way, give us references on all the people that we're looking at. And they like to have a group of people who are like themselves, very driven, very motivated, differentiated. You know, ultimately, performance is what it's about, and that's what we're seeking to put together is, you know, we don't want to just pick from the best things that are crossing our desk. We want to put together the best fund based on performance, and it really helps to have a manager set that's done a great job and that, you know, not only can point you to people who we think, you know, maybe we should be working with, but importantly also steer you away from other people, you know, where it's maybe not appropriate, not as good a fit. But having that dynamic is a very positive one to, you know, make those additions and, you know, take on that early fund risk when you're working with a fund one, fund two. You know, it's very helpful to have the insight of people who've been in business for a long time to guide you on that.
Jerry.
Just a quick question on the due diligence process. You indicate that it's an interesting note here. Third-party background checks are not always possible in emerging markets. Do you find that there's a geographic concentration to that that limitation, and how concerned are you about it? Is there a particular part, emerging market, that's a particular concern to you, and how much concern?
Part of the mitigant would be on page 22. You look and see where we're investing our capital. It's very difficult to do diligence checking, as you say, in emerging markets. China is a great example. And we therefore have not put a lot of the fund in that area. We would rather, though, work with management teams that might actually be from the U.S., that might join in joint venture with people from China, or Western management teams that are working in an area like China. Not to say we wouldn't work with a Chinese manager. We work with a lot of Chinese managers in other areas, venture capital, private equity, and so forth. but it's a little more difficult. And I think, again, the way we mitigate that is just by having less of our capital there, perhaps. But, you know, a number of the people in emerging markets would have worked at companies maybe where I worked or banks or so forth, and we can kind of indirectly check them out through our own network.
It's very helpful having a Beijing office and having two of our people focus just on due diligence who are Mandarin speakers, and so they can do their own referencing in Mandarin through their networks. And
I suspected helpful. That you might say China, and it's not what you would call a transparent society. So what kind of degree of reliability you place on, just because you speak Mandarin doesn't necessarily mean you can drill down very deep into the people's background.
No,
that's why we're very careful.
And in our colleague Li Nong's case, he's a native Chinese. It's a lot of great contacts. We've actually not done things as a result of things that he's found out where other people, very high quality, other investors have, and it's because of his insight and contact base. And so it's really helpful having him there in China.
Thank you.
I might move backwards to slide 20, and I want to make sure that we're demonstrating that these are fairly diversified portfolios. When we started back on page 20 on the left-hand side, back in 1995, that fund was dominantly focused in the green part of the bar in oil and gas. You can see two-thirds. So that was 18 years ago. That's a very high-quality, great-performing fund. In 2003, you can see that reduced a bit. That fund also is a very successful fund. Here we are raising our ninth fund, and we think oil and gas will still be a pretty big part of what we've done, 35% to 50%. We also, though, have other parts of the spectrum, and you'll see much more focus on, in this case, mining in green, infrastructure in blue, the services industries in the brown. And the reason for that is the world has changed. We want to evolve with the world. We also, though, have a much larger team and deeper team, much more technical and operating and practical experience in all different channels of natural resources, and that's really brought us to a different opportunity set. I would also mention on page 21, we talked about primaries, secondaries, and co-investing. You can see in our last fund, Fund 8, about three-quarters of that fund where we were investing in primary managers. So managers, SCF Partners raising the next fund, a blind pool, no investments yet. We commit to it, and then they build that over the next 3, 5, 7 years. We also, though, are very active in secondaries. In fact, we just hired another person at Common Fund Capital to focus on secondaries. We're trying to build out an entire team of people that just focus on secondaries in our organization, because it's become even more specialized. Our performance there has been, we think, very solid. You can see a 35% rate of return on secondaries in our last fund. Most of those bought after the credit crisis, when a lot of people were exiting these long-term lockup securities. That was a great time to be buying. And then the co-investment area, also an important part of what we do. Those two areas, co-investments as an example, we think they're attractive because we can actually generally invest with no fee and no carry. So if we're doing our job right, we can generate higher performance to our investors on a net basis. We do all that, by the way, for one fee. Page 24 just depicts all of our performance across time, starting with our first fund back in 1988. Those two first funds, we think, were very pleased with the performance. Those were mezzanine in orientation. So it was actually lending money to U.S. companies and getting a coupon plus potentially an equity kicker. And those performance, we think, again, is very strong for mezzanine-style investing.
Yep. What was going on in 98 that created such a high
Well, bar? That's back when Terry asked
Fund four, when Terry asked
the question, when we talked about oil prices going into $9 a barrel,
yeah.
We were buying oil at $9 a barrel back then. So, and now oil is trading at $93 a barrel. So we had a really nice tailwind, you might call it inflation. And, you know, it's a very cyclical marketplace. I would say, though, Fund 3 and 4, where when they first started, we started in 95, we were buying oil at 3 and 4 times higher than that. Uh-huh. And so we went through a really tough cycle, but we stuck with it. That's a great long, it was a great long-term set of assets, and we came out and have generated, as you can see on the right-hand side, very strong cash-on-cash multiples.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's important, back to our earlier point about how you don't really know how you're doing until, you know, 10 years in. Those funds early on didn't have the best looking returns. In fact, our later funds, the 2007, 2008, those less mature funds are actually tracking better than Fund 3 and 4 did at a similar maturity stage. And you just don't know how the cycle goes. The returns really came to the fore fairly late in the game in Funds 3 and 4.
So okay. When I joined in 95, we changed the strategy from a mezzanine strategy to more of a equity strategy and more of a, more diversity. And we thought we'd achieve some really strong performance with about the same amount of risk as mezzanine in some cases. And I think that's what happened. And we've really stuck with that strategy since 1995.
One of the things in managing a natural resources real assets program that may be subtle but we think is important is that in order to get that diversification benefit, you don't want to be too hedged in your program. So we do a lot of work with our managers. We have over 12,000 companies in our database, and one of the pieces of data that we pick up is how hedged are the managers, and what we try to encourage them to do is not to over-hedge, because then you lose that diversification. What this reflects, obviously, is the fact that, you know, you had in some areas a commodity tailwind, and that's precisely, you know, what you want a program like this to do, is to pick up, you know, the tracking on those prices. And so in order to ensure that that's done or that's available in the program, that's where we, you know, one of the things that we take a look at with managers that we work with.
I'd like to try to bring this to a close. Is there any final comment you'd like to make?
Sure. So we have a detailed example of how our fee works, but why don't we jump to page 26, which is where I would like to close. And we've listed here some of the reasons that we think we would make a good partner for Contra Costa, but let me just summarize by saying our experienced team, our historical track record, our opportunistic strategy, we think put us in a solid position for being a leading investor in the future in real assets and natural resources. And as I began, we would really be honored to work with you. You would be an important client to us. You would get a lot of attention from us. And we would really look forward to the opportunity to helping you achieve your goals in this investment area. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you.
If you'd like to come around and meet the board members, you might take a few minutes to do that. And then we'll go on to taking a break for the board. Let's see if we can get back here by 11:20, folks. And we'll begin our next...